Today's guest, at one point in her life, was fondly dubbed Janine the Machine. And so she was, well on her way to becoming part of the Australian cross-country ski team. And then something very unexpected happened. Welcome, Janine Shepherd, an author of Defiant, A Broken Body is Not a Broken Person. Janine, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. It's just a delight to speak to you, Pamela. Thank you.
Now, Janine, you heard me say a moment ago, you were dubbed Janine the Machine. That was your name. You earned it. you lived it. But then one day, something huge happened that really changed your life forever. Can you take us to that day when you were riding?
Right. Well, let me firstly back up and say, Janine the Machine, most people would think that's not really flattering. But, you know, I took it as a great compliment as an athlete. It was, you know, it was reflective of my mindset, which was, you know, hardworking and determined and persistent. And, you know, all of my training partners knew what I was like. And so that was my nickname, Janine the Machine. And I was a member of the Australian ski team, and I was headed for the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary. And I think for anyone out there that, you know, understands or appreciates sport, you know, this was, you know, the pinnacle. I mean, most athletes dream about getting to the Olympics, and that was, you know, my lifelong dream. I'd been an athlete my entire life from, you know, the age of seven, really, with track and field and various other sports at national level. So I was on top of the world. I'd been training overseas. I had been approached by the Canadian ski team coach, who offered me a position with their team to join up with them and use their facilities in the lead up to the Olympics. So I was on top of the world, and nothing was going to stop me. And then I was on a training bike ride with my teammates. We were riding from Sydney to the Blue Mountains, which is around about a 6-hour ride from Sydney, up through the hills. That was my favorite part of my training, the hills, and partly why I had that nickname. And about 5.5 hours into the ride, I just remember looking up, getting up off the seat of my bike and looking up into the sun, and then that was my last memory. Everything went black.
And you were the only woman on that team, is that correct?
On that particular ride, yeah. Okay. I was the only, yeah. Because it was such a grueling ride, none of the other girls could keep up with the guys. And, you know, I really prided myself on not just training with the guys, but, oh, I was driven to beat them. So I often did. So it was sort of a fun game we had.
But that day, you were, as you said, you were on top of the world in so many ways. And then there was an accident. Can you tell us what you know of the accident?
Well, my experience, of course, and, you know, it's really interesting because I had what I call my death experience, not my near-death experience, but that's one part of it. I'll tell you what happened from the outside, from what I've put together and, of course, written about at length about what happened to my body, is that I was hit by a speeding truck and suffered extensive and life-threatening injuries. So I was lying on the side of the road. In fact, a lady was driving past and saw something flying through the air, and that was me, and they stopped and went back, and she sat by my side, and she said it was the worst thing she's ever seen in her life. And the ambulance were called. Fortunately, they reached me within probably 8 to 10 minutes. I had broken my neck and my back in 6 places, 5 ribs on my left side, my right arm, my collarbones, and bones in my feet, head injuries, internal injuries. And that was one, you know, of course, obvious threat to my life. But probably the most dangerous part at that point was the massive internal bleeding. In fact, I lost about 5 liters of blood, which is, you know, all someone my size would actually hold. they took me to, they rushed me to the local hospital. And in fact, I only recently found out, I returned to Australia and went back to the scene of the accident and met the paramedic that was first on the scene for the first time. And he told me a story that I didn't know, which was when they arrived at the hospital, the doctor there said that they weren't going to fly me out of the hospital. He said, because there was no use. I wasn't going to make it. So he had to intervene and call a senior surgeon who came down and said, call the helicopter now. And they flew blood up. And of course, the helicopter pilots didn't think that I'd survive the flight to Sydney. But that was a moment that obviously changed my life forever.
And that was a person who changed your life forever when he insisted on requesting assistance for you, even though the doctor had decided that there was no particular point.
Absolutely. His name's Gary. I actually, as I said, I went back to the scene of the accident, and while we were there, he actually gave me his, he's now retired, he gave me his ambulance badge, the first one he received when he was admitted into the ambulance service. It was a very emotional moment for me. But had he not said that and gone to get his friend, I would have died at the hospital.
And, you know, I would think in doing that, I mean, in that in and of itself is like a huge conversation, because in mm-hmm. making that call, he was actually going against orders and could have had some jeopardy attached to his employment, which ultimately would have would have impacted on his life.
Absolutely. You know, it was just his, he just knew. I mean, paramedics are just amazing, the things that they do and the things that they see. And he just knew that this, you know, there was more to this than, you know, what this doctor was calling. And of course, this doctor was also the one that was on duty, was a brand new, fresh doctor that had flown in from England. It was his first assignment, actually, at this hospital. And I think he was just way out of his depth. And, you know, it was only Gary calling the senior surgeon. In fact, not only calling him, the senior surgeon was actually in surgery at the time. He dropped everything and someone else took over and went to see me in the emergency. So he just took over and overrode the decision and called the helicopter.
So several people were active participants in saving your life.
Oh, absolutely. And that was only the beginning. I mean, from there, the crew that flew me down, of course, and also in the helicopter crew, one of the guys that was working on the helicopter, that was also his first assignment. So I think for a lot of people, it was sort of sorely thrown in the deep end. And of course, then I got to Prince Henry Hospital in Sydney. They overflew another hospital. They took me straight to the spinal ward. And of course, then it was just complete mayhem. My parents had to drive 6 hours in pouring rain. Firstly, to the first hospital they were told that I was going to. I didn't arrive there. Then to this other hospital on the other side of the city. They'd never been there before. And of course, they arrived. The doctors were fighting to keep me alive. They were pumping blood into my body. My parents were told, you know, there's nothing more we can do. Just prepare for the worst. And, you know, overall, I spent 6 months in hospital, but the first 10 days were critical days that they didn't think that I would pull through.
And in fact, you said that you spent 10 days living in death. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I had left my body. I mean, you know, it's a very personal experience. It's, you know, I wrote very briefly about it, and it's took me a long time to make sense of it. But I really was in and out of my body for that whole time. You know, I can remember being somewhere else. I can remember being guided through the experience. I can remember being with people, with beings. And I remember that it was my choice that, you know, that I saw my life almost as if, you know, I could see it on a film screen. You know, I could see that my body was broken and that it would no longer serve me as it had before as an athlete. And so I was very aware that I didn't want to go back to that body, and that my life, I could see my life projected into the future, a life with disability, and I didn't want to choose that. And it was the fight of my life. And there were parts of me, you know, it was almost like slipping in and out of dimensions, in my body and in pain, and then leaving my body and pain free. And for whatever reason, after 10 days, I woke up back in my body, and the overwhelming emotion was one of confusion. You know, what am I doing back here? This wasn't what was meant to happen.
And how old were you at that time?
I was 24.
So in so many ways, I mean, truly at the beginning of your life, and a life that you had prepared for most of your life, and all of a sudden it was different. At that point, the doctors were telling you and your parents what about your likelihood of recovery?
Well, at first they told my parents, don't tell her anything. When she's ready, she'll ask. I think I had so many injuries that I think they thought it's going to be overwhelming. She won't be able to cope. And I think they're probably right. And it just seemed to be every time I would get on top of one injury, you know, there'd be something else. Oh, you've broken your back. And, you know, oh, by the way, you've broken your neck. You know, and oh, by the way, you've broken something else. And one memory that's very vivid for me was, you know, them saying, well, we're just going to do a few tests. And I remember they said, we're going to get a pin and we're just going to prick your legs and tell us when you can feel it. And I can remember thinking, well, okay, like, I think you should start now. And of course, they had been pricking my legs the whole time, and I had no feeling in my legs, nor did I have any movement in my legs.
That's pretty scary.
Oh, yeah, it was. You know, and I think that I had so many injuries. I was in such a high level of pain. It was just all-consuming. I've never really experienced anything with so many broken bones. My whole, the truck that hit me, it hit me from behind, obviously. My torso was bruised, black and blue and swollen. And, of course, that was another great concern with the, you know, the bruising and the all sorts of swelling in my body. And I kept thinking every time, you know, something like that would happen, I kept thinking, no, they're wrong. They're wrong. It's going to be okay. They're wrong. Because it's a sort of thing that, I mean, for an athlete, it was my worst nightmare. I think most people would admit that waking up paralyzed in a spinal ward is probably up there with one of their worst, the worst thing that could happen to you. And I kept thinking, this can't be happening. It's not my reality. I'll wake up and it'll all be over. I'll be back home. And I think in a way that was a protective mechanism for me.
You talk about being in the spinal ward during in your book Defiant, but also in a TED Talk that you gave. Can you give us sort of a sense of what that experience was like?
Gosh, it was, in many ways, it was such a lonely, painful, scary experience. You know, lying flat on your back, you can't move, you're just in such a high level of pain, and there's no day and night. You know, everything drifts into one, and of course you can't move. I was lying on my back. I was looking up at the roof. I couldn't even turn my head. I had a neck brace around my neck and sandbags on either side of my head. You know, I was paralyzed from the waist down, and my life just revolved around, you know, moment to moment, just getting through the next moment with pain. And yet, in other ways, it was this very rich experience. You know, I was moved from intensive care to another ward, which is called acute spinal. I shared that ward with five other people. And these were people that I normally would have had nothing to do with. You know, I was at university, I mixed with athletes, and that was my life. And suddenly I was in this situation where I was with five other people, came from completely different lives, you know, lifestyles than I did. Never had, you know, I would have had nothing in common with them before. And suddenly I had everything in common with them. And, you know, they'd all been in accidents of some sort. You know, there was two young people that had been in car accidents, someone that had been in a surfing, swimming accident, a lady that had fallen downstairs, and another man that had been in a horse riding accident. And even though our lives were so different in many ways, suddenly everything was the same for us. You know, I realized there was this sense of connection and sameness and shared experience, and we had the same hopes and dreams and fears, and we pulled together in that spinal ward in a way that I'd never experienced before. You know, when somebody, you know, invariably would get wheeled off for a test or a surgery or something, you know, we would all, you know, wish them luck and wait, anticipate for them to come back, and we were just there for each other.
You know, I hear you using the words hopes, dreams, and fears. I don't hear anger. Were you angry about this accident?
You know, Pamela, I was, but that took a long time. I think in hospital it was just, you know, I was in this sort of survival mode of just getting through that experience. And also, I didn't have any perspective, really, of what my future held. So, you know, it was just getting through the next day, getting through the pain, getting, you know, closer and closer and looking forward to leaving the hospital. It wasn't until I got home months later when I started to obviously recover, not physically, but, you know, the pain subsided, that I really did experience an enormous amount of anger, particularly towards the driver that had run me over.
Did the driver ever reach out to you?
No, but I reached out to him, and that was an interesting story. You know, I managed to get his name, and then I managed to find out his phone number, and I rang him. I just, you know, I had a wonderful social worker in hospital who had given me some exercises. You know, I'd started writing letters and writing down my feelings. And I felt this, he had, by the way, he wrote to me. He did actually write to me. So I'll back up there and say he did reach out, and that he wrote a letter to me that was sent from a legal firm. Obviously, his solicitor had told him to write it. And he said, "Dear Miss Lee," now Lee is my middle name, so he got my name wrong for a start. He said, "I'm the driver of the vehicle with which you collided."
Yep, that's from a law office.
Absolutely, and I thought, what did I pedal backwards or something? I could, you know, I was dumbfounded. You know, and then he said, "I failed to see it was my fault," something along those lines. Anyway, I discarded it at the time, and it was much later when I got home that I thought, you know, I need to ring him. I need to ring him and tell him what he's done to my life. He didn't come to visit me in hospital. There was nothing, and so I picked up the phone and I called him. And I think there was this, you know, when he heard my name, this pregnant pause on the end of the phone. And I just wanted to talk to him. I wanted to hear his voice. I wanted to put, you know, a human voice to this experience. And I remember him saying, "Oh, you know, we'll keep in contact." And he had all my details, and I hung up, and I never heard from him again. I wrote a letter. I put everything down in this letter. And I didn't have an address for him, and I posted it regardless. And that was my way of working through these feelings. And, of course, forgiveness is a huge part of this experience as well.
Absolutely. And forgiveness for so many is such a complicated concept. Because, you know, many people think that forgiveness means condoning the behavior, and clearly that is not part of forgiveness at all. But it, you know, the fact that you would get a letter misaddressed, if you will, essentially telling you that the problem that you were having was on you, is really kind of extraordinary, and on so many levels.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you know, all I wanted simply was for him to say, "I'm sorry." I wanted him to accept some responsibility, because I then went through all of these complicated feelings of guilt. You know, I saw what my parents were going through. I felt that I was to blame. Of course, you know, that was, it didn't make sense. But it for me, you know, I just wanted him to say, "I'm sorry," and that he cared. And, You're right. I mean, forgiveness was not about, oh, it's okay. Forgiveness was just letting go. That's all it is. Forgiveness, I didn't forgive for him. I forgave for me. And I knew that I felt that, okay, he's done this. You know, this has happened in my life, but I'm not going to let him have any more control over the way I see my future. And that is the moment that I really let go of him and found forgiveness in my life.
Janine Shepherd, author of a powerful memoir entitled Defiant, A Broken Body is Not a Broken Person. We will take a break and be back in just a moment. That you were in the hospital for 6 months and then you were home. What physical condition were you in when you went home?
Well, I was firstly covered in a plaster body cast, so my whole torso was covered in plaster. I was attached to a catheter bottle and I was in a wheelchair. So I had to learn how to self-catheter. That's one of the complications of spinal cord injury that many people don't understand. And I always say that as an ambassador for spinal cord injury, you know, people think that spinal cord injury is all about walking again, but of course it's not. It's much more complicated than that. There's all the hidden sides of spinal cord injury, which I had, you know, loss of feeling, you know, bladder and bowel damage, et cetera, et cetera. So I had to learn to self-catheter. And of course, I was determined to learn to walk again. They didn't know at that stage, after the complicated spinal surgery that I had a little flicker in one of my big toes, and they thought that was a really good sign. And they thought that, you know, there was a potential that I might learn to walk again. But they said if I did, it would be with calipers on my leg and a walking frame. So basically, I was told that I would have to rethink everything that I did in my life because I would never be able to do the things I did before.
You were, at some point, you were at home. You were in your wheelchair, in your body cast. And you looked up to the sky and said something really kind of odd to yourself. Tell us what you said to yourself.
Well, let me just, that was a remarkable moment. And I'll just back up before that, before I got to that moment, actually. And you asked me about, you know, the feelings that I had when I got home. I suffered a very serious depression when I got home and reality hit and I thought, this is my life. And there were moments when I, you know, I thought to myself, I just don't want to be in this body. This is not my life. And, you know, I thought seriously about how do I get out of this body. And I think I, despite that, and there were days when I could not even get out of my bed. And I always say to people, I remember vividly my mum sitting on the end of my bed, both of us crying. And I remember she said to me, I wonder if life will ever be good again. And I thought, how can it? You know, I've lost everything. And despite that, there was part of me that was very aware that I'd made this choice. I was back in this body and I wanted to know why. I thought, I have to find out. I have to find the why. And I felt that I needed to do that not just for myself but for my mum and dad because they were suffering terribly. And I think that was the moment that I let go. I decided that if I'm going to keep hanging on to, you know, the ideal of my life as an athlete and those dreams, I'll never be able to move forward. So I made a decision that I would let go of that life and create a new one. And that was the moment that I was sitting outside and looked up and an aeroplane flew over. And in the most remarkable and unlikely way, I thought to myself, well, if I can't walk, then maybe I can fly. And I think my mum thought I was completely crazy.
That is not a surprising reaction from a parent, given, you know, the physical circumstances with which you were confronted, physical and medical circumstances with which you were confronted at that moment. I want to go back for just a second. You talked about the depression that you experience. Would you say that depression is something that individuals who experience spinal cord injury is a common feature of their recovery?
Very common. Very common. And, you know, I know that there are different ways to treat it, but I mean, spinal cord injury is a devastating illness. And one of the complications of spinal cord injury is chronic pain. And chronic pain and depression actually share common pathways. So if you suffer from chronic pain, you have a much greater tendency to also suffer depression. And they're not, I know that people are not quite sure how this works, but often people with spinal cord injury are treated with antidepressants, mainly for pain management as well. But yes, depression is a very common consequence of spinal cord injury.
You said that you didn't want to be in the body in which you were residing. Mm. Did you have any conscious thought about suicide?
To be honest, absolutely, I thought about it. I didn't actually make plans for it, but I daydreamed about it. I thought, well, that would be a great way out of this, a great escape. And, you know, but despite that, as I mentioned, I had this unwavering belief that my life was still worthwhile, that I came back for a reason, and that there's got to be something out there that I can do, and I need to find out. I can't give up. You know, As I said, I've always loved the hills, and this was the biggest hill I'd ever faced in my life. But despite that, I thought I need to recreate my life. I need to give it a chance.
When you had the really peculiar idea that if you couldn't walk, you could at least fly, and your mother thought you had lost your mind, did you accept that and come up with another plan, or what did you do next?
Oh, no. I rang up the flying school that was near, the closest one near my house, and made a booking to go in. I got a friend to come up from another state, and covered in a plaster body cast and a big pair of baggy overalls, my mum and my friend drove me out to the local airport, carried me into the flying school. And honestly, they took one look at me and thought I was crazy too. And I had booked in for what's called a trial instructional flight. And they lifted me into the aircraft and they took me flying. And that moment changed my life forever.
How? How so?
It was, I'd never even wanted to fly before. I'd never even been near a light aircraft. But, you know, once those wheels lifted off the runway and we were airborne, it was the most incredible sense of freedom. If you can even imagine lying paralyzed in a spinal ward and then, you know, being in an aeroplane. And the flying instructor that took me up that day let me take the controls with my hands and fly the aeroplane. And, you know, flying is, I think, to me, you know, one of the most spiritual experiences you can have, you know, unlimited, unbounded. And it was just, I was absolutely filled with joy at that moment. And I thought to myself, I'm going to do this. I can do this.
And how did you set about actually doing that? You were in a body cast. What was moving was your hands. That was kind of it.
Yeah, I know. Well, that was all the motivation I needed. You know, I mean, the thing is, when you suffer, you know, a setback in life like this, and all your dreams are crushed, what, you know, the most important, one of the most important things is to have hope, you know, hope for the future, hope that you can do something. And, you know, in fact, I'm really interested in the whole concept of hope and how we, you know, sort of reset our goals. And to me, that was, you know, having a new goal was enough to motivate me to get out of bed every day and throw myself into my rehabilitation. You know, every day at first, you know, the only thing I could do was, Mum used to help me lie on the ground, and I used to lift my legs probably 1 inch. It took every ounce of my, you know, being to just do that. And of course, I had to learn to self-catheter, which was one of the most humiliating and frustrating experiences. But I knew that to be able to go out and to be free, I had to be able to do that as well.
Let me ask and you this, if you are up to it. For those who don't know what you mean when you say self-catheter, are you up to giving a thumbnail sketch of what that means?
Sure. Well, I do write about that in some detail in my book. And so, you know, I can't go to the bathroom like a normal person. So I have to put a little thin tube inside so that I can, you know, void my bladder. And it's a very challenging thing to do, you know, to get it in the right spot. And I thought, oh, you know, I'm never going to be able to do this. It's a very frustrating thing. And, of course, a very important thing if you need to go out. You've got to be clean. Of course, one of the complications of that is infection. Every time you do it, you know, there's a chance that you get an infection into the bladder and a urinary tract infection. In fact, that's another complication of spinal cord injury, living with constant urinary tract infections, being on medication, a high level of medication, which I've been on, you know, my entire life now, having to take antibiotics every single day to prevent UTIs. So, you know, that was, you know, if I didn't self-catheter, I would have had to have a bag attached to my body, and I didn't want to do that. So, you know, I had to learn to self-catheter, obviously. But I was determined. I have to do this. I'm going to learn to do this. I had to do it lying down with a mirror between my legs so I could see in the beginning. I think I'm pretty adept at it now. It's been a long time. So I had to learn to do that. And then, of course, keep on with my exercises. Then I, you know, finally got to the point where I used to push my wheelchair around, and then Mum would take me to the local pool, and that was also a wonderful sense of freedom that I could move my body in the water, and I started swimming. So months and months passed, and then during that time, my Mum would take me out to the airport, and they'd put me in an aircraft, and they let me go up and use my hands and fly the aircraft. And I got books that I needed to study for my license, and I started studying all these, you know, strange and wonderful aeronautical terms. And months and months and months passed, and eventually I went for a medical, and that was an interesting experience as well. So I eventually passed my medical and was cleared to learn to fly.
I would think that the doctor you saw for your medical to get a license to fly was a little bit surprised.
That is an understatement. You know, he was a wonderful old gentleman. He had, you know, glasses on the end of his nose, and my mum was sort of holding me up, and I, at that point, was walking, sort of waddling, holding onto my mum, covered in a, you know, plaster body cast. You know, oh, I'm here for my pilot's medical. And, you know, I remember he got out the form, you know, and he said, now let's start from the beginning, you know. And eventually, I mean, he was just most aviation medical examiners are very enthusiastic pilots. So, of course, he was, he would do everything he could possible to enable me to experience the joy of flight. And he did, and we went through the medical, of course, and I think I had every single thing on the form. You know, ever had a head injury, ever broken this, ever done that, yep. And eventually, you know, I remember him sort of taking off his glasses and looking at me and saying, well, "You know, Janine, I really want you to fly." He said, "But I don't want you to kill anybody." I was, "Okay."
So, good thought.
Yeah. He said, "If we can get a letter from your surgeon, then I'm going to recommend we pass you." And, of course, he wrote the letter to the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, and I had to then go back and see my surgeon and convince him that even though I couldn't move my legs, you know, I'd be able to do this. And, you know, long story short, we sent it off down to Canberra, and months and months passed. I kept on with my theory study, and the letter eventually came back, and that was my green light. They'd passed me.
And so today, what are you doing with your pilot's license?
Yeah. Well, I went on. I got my private pilot's license. It's a little different these days. It was firstly separated into, you know, being able to fly around the airport and just taking off and landing and then carrying passengers. And then I learned to navigate, and I flew around Australia and got what's called my unrestricted license. And then I thought, oh, that's it. That's about as far as I can go. And, of course, the guy that ran the flying school said, "If you know, Janine, if you got your commercial pilot's license and your instructor rating, I'll give you a job." Well, that sounded completely crazy to me. You know, I'm now a walking paraplegic. You know, I thought, what, me? Teaching people how to fly? But flying had become my life. It had given me my life back. So I went and had another medical, went back to that same doctor and was cleared for my commercial. I went on, I got my twin engine rating, my instrument rating so that I could fly in cloud as well as fine weather, got my commercial pilot's license, my instructor rating, and then I found myself back at that same school where I had gone for that TIFF, teaching other people how to fly in around 18 months after I'd left the spinal ward.
18 months.
Mm.
That is an extraordinarily, it seems to me, short period of time, particularly given the extreme nature of your injuries.
Oh, it was intense. I mean, it was, as I said, it saved my life. It gave me my life back. It's all I could do. I mean, I felt that I had nothing else. I couldn't go back to my university degree. I wanted to be an exercise physiologist. I didn't want to be around my athletic friends. It was my new world. It was this incredible, new, exciting world. And it was important to me. I felt that I had something to prove, you know, to the doctors that told me I wouldn't be able to do anything, to everybody else. But in fact, it was only to myself that I had something to prove. And, you know, it was so important for my self-esteem that I was doing something that, you know, in my eyes was extraordinary. And I loved it. I loved every moment. I loved taking people up and teaching them how to fly. And might I add, it didn't stop there. I then learned to fly an aeroplane upside down and became an aerobatics flying instructor.
Janine the Machine. That's all one can say. Let me ask you this. At one point when you were in school, you were studying law, correct?
Yeah, that was my first degree. I enrolled in law. I actually didn't start. I enrolled in law, and then I took a year off and traveled overseas and came back and thought, no, I really don't want to do that. So then I enrolled in languages and a degree, an education degree also in human movement studies.
But, you know, with a law degree, you know, you can certainly experience a horrific physical difficulty and practice law. And that's perhaps a little bit easier than deciding to fly. But doing it the easy way doesn't sound like that ever kind of crosses your – or easier way doesn't sound like that ever crosses your mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, I feel that I didn't actually choose flying. I think that flying chose me. I think that's, you know, how life works, I think. And what I say is, you know, in the name of my book, Defiant, I always say defiance is not an act of the mind. Defiance is an expression of the soul. And I think that I was very in tune with, you know, my intuitive side that was just able to listen and to let go and to just be open to, you know, the possibilities of my life and listening to, you know, the messages from my soul.
Janine, you were 24 as your life changed in ways that you could never have imagined. somewhere along the line, marriage happened, three children happened. Tell us about that journey.
Mm. Well, of course, when I left the hospital, or actually when I was still in the hospital, I can remember the doctors telling my father, in fact, that they didn't think I'd ever be able to have children because of the extent of my internal injuries. And there was also, you know, an extraordinary experience, which I've written about in Defiant, for the very first time, when I got home from hospital. Another complication of spinal cord injury, of course, is that it affects sexual function. I can remember being wheeled into a doctor's office, a male doctor's office, and him saying to me, "Well, Janine, you know, it's about time we talk about your sex life." And I can remember being horrified and saying, "Well, you know, isn't there a female doctor we can talk to?" "Oh, no, you know, I'm it. Sorry, the female doctor's overseas." And you'll find this extraordinary, but he actually said to me, "You know, there's no reason you can't have a, you know, a healthy relationship, but you'll know you'll never have the big O again." And I was just horrified. I remember sitting there and trying to hold back my tears. I didn't want to show him, you know, a moment of what I would consider a weakness in front of him. And I can remember going home and you know, that was a moment, actually, when I consider probably my rock bottom. So, you know, with those sort of messages in the back of my mind, and that sort of prognosis, you know, it took me a long time to be able to open up to having a relationship. I thought I wouldn't be able to have a relationship. I felt that I wouldn't be able to be a woman. And, you know, eventually at the flying school, I met a fellow flying instructor, and it took a long time for me to trust. That was a really big thing for me, and to feel that I could do this. But I did. I took that leap, and eventually Tim did ask me to get married, and I can remember, you know, saying to him, "I don't think I'll be able to have children." And nevertheless, we did get married, and I'm the mother of three absolutely gorgeous children, which, you know, being a mother wasn't something I thought was something that I would enjoy so much, but it has been just a remarkable experience for me.
You were told first, you know, the subtitle of your book might be "All the Things That Medical Personnel Should Never Allow to Come Out of Their Mouths." First it was you weren't going to survive. Then it was, well, you were surviving, but you weren't going to walk. Then, yes, you know, you weren't going to walk, but you weren't going to have children. Then, and the big O, which is just kind of extraordinary, that a doctor, that anybody would say that, but certainly a physician. You kept getting all these messages about what couldn't happen in your life.
Yeah.
And yet you continued on. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things people always say, "Oh, well, you know, you don't want to give a patient false hope." And my answer to that would be, well, perhaps false hope is better than no hope. And who's to say that it's false anyway? I mean, I think messages like that become self-fulfilling prophecies. I know that you know, my books in Australia have been used extensively by medical staff. And, you know, it's another reason I think it's, you know, to be able to read a book that's written from a patient's perspective is very important for them. And I think important for them as health practitioners to become more compassionate and empathic towards, you know, what it is like to be a patient. You know, we're not just a number in a hospital bed. We're human beings, you know, having this life-changing experience, and they need to be very, you know, aware of that.
Absolutely. You know, I again, as I look through your book and listen to your conversations, it seems like almost all of the things that one could never imagine actually having to go through, and certainly not all in one person's life, you have had to experience. You married, you had wonderful children, but then at some point there was an ending to that marriage. Mm. And your financial world sort of was upended as well.
I know. I think I've had every experience possible. I make a joke. I say, maybe I was in the wrong line when I lined up for this particular, life of mine. But, it has been incredibly rich as well. And I've written, this is my sixth book. I've written previous books in Australia. In fact, my life story was made into a movie in Australia. But those books have only covered certain experiences in my life. And, I say that not everyone is an Olympic athlete going, to represent their country at the Olympics. But, Defiant is such a broad range of experiences. It not only covers my accident, but all of the subsequent challenges that I've had in my life. I did get married. My husband suffered a very serious illness that threatened our marriage and made it untenable. And of course, then we divorced, and I faced the next 10 years as a single mother with a disability, which was extremely challenging. And then the GFC came along, the financial crisis, and because I was trying to work and support my children, I suffered a great financial hardship and ended up losing my house and having to start again. Reinventing my life is, something that I've had to do many, many times. And I think, I look back and I see that there's a gift in every experience that we go through in life. And that's been one of the tools in my life, in my toolbox, so to speak, that's been, enabled me to get where I am today. And, if it wasn't for those experiences, of course, I wouldn't have come to America, and I wouldn't have given my TED talk, which now has almost 2 million views and has led me to this point in my life, which has been an extraordinary life journey.
And let me speak to the TED talk for a moment, because we've been talking about your experiences of being in a body cast, of being in a wheelchair, of really being substantially mobility challenged. The TED talk, you were kind of standing and sitting and moving all about the stage.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Well, of course, I am up and walking now, and I walk with a significant limp, and in that, you probably don't notice in the TED talk, but at one point I almost fall off the stage because I'm very challenged with my balance, and I was standing on a very dark stage. But I walk around the stage. I actually have chairs there, which are a wonderful prop for me because they give me an opportunity to sit down and rest my legs. But there's another backstory to those chairs as well, in that I'm a great fan of Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, and his hero's journey. And I use those chairs to sort of represent the hero's journey that I think we're all on. And each of those chairs represents a different stage of the journey. And I wanted that talk to be symbolic of not only my journey, but the journey that we're all on, the sort of shared human experience. And I think that when I'm on stage and sharing my story, I feel like what I am is a mirror, and I'm holding that up for other people to be able to see their own journey, their own personal journey in my journey, and to see that the common stages and challenges that we go through, the point where we struggle, the point where we want to give up, the point where we need to accept, the point where we overcome, when we, take the wisdom from our experience and then go out into the world and share it. I mean, I think that is a pattern that we all go through.
I thought that the staging of that TED Talk was really brilliant and, so appropriate for your life, as you said, the stages and all the things that you've experienced. You tell a story about straws and the spinal cord injury unit. Can you share that with our listeners today?
I do. I think it's been that was such a seminal moment in my life, being in the spinal ward, in that acute ward that I talked about. At one point, we're all of us remember lying on our back looking up at the ceiling. We can't see what each other looks like. We're talking and creating these relationships, but we have no idea what each other looks like. And one point, one of the nurses came into the ward with a pack of plastic straws, and he put those straws on each of us and asked us to start threading those straws together, which we did. And when we had threaded our own pile of straws, he went around and joined all of the straws up until they looped around the ward and they passed over the top of each of us. And he said, he was all excited, jumping about. He said, "Okay, everyone, hold on to your straws." And we did. He said, "Right, now we're all connected." And it was this really profound moment where I realized that, you know, that we're all the same, that we're all going through this experience together and we needed each other to get through it. And I really believe that. I mean, you know, often we go through life and we think that we're alone in our experience, and that, you know, nobody would ever understand what we're going through. But in fact, everyone is going through their own struggle. And it might look different, but we're all going through it. And we need to remind ourselves of that.
You talk about the disability and what that meant for you. And so many times there is such bias and so many myths around the concept of disability. You know, people, if they can't see your disability, they often will decide that you don't have one. yeah. Or if they can see your disability, you know, it still happens that you can be in a wheelchair and someone won't talk to you. They'll talk to the person around you or they'll yell because somehow being in a wheelchair means you can't hear. I mean, there's so many myths and misconceptions about disability. For those listening who have had their own varying experiences with disabilities, what would you like for them to think about?
Well, I've experienced, you know, so many of those emotions that you touched upon. I mean, when I was in a wheelchair, I remember sitting outside the spinal ward and people walking past and not wanting to look at me. I mean, people find wheelchairs very threatening, I think partly because the thought of even being in one themselves is just too frightening. And, you know, of course, getting home and all the emotions that came with my physical body and my problems and the catheter and the big O and all of those things. But despite that, I realized that inside I was exactly the same. You know, that was a very important moment for me, you know, realizing that I was still Janine the machine. My body might have changed, but I was still the same. And in fact, my TED Talk, the original title of my TED Talk, came about. I was interviewed by Mike Ludengren, who ran TEDx Kansas City, where I gave my talk, and he said, "You know, you've got such an incredible story. What's the most important lesson that you've learned?" And I looked at him and I thought, "Well, I think the most important lesson is that I'm not my body." He said, "Now that's a TED talk." So that was the original title of my talk, You're Not Your Body. And I think that's a really important message for anyone that suffers a disability.
A broken body is not a broken person.
Exactly. I mean, we are not our bodies. We're not our minds. We, you know, we're none of those things. We're not the roles that we give ourselves in life. You know, we are the defiant human spirit. And when we see that in ourselves, we see it in everybody.
What's your sense of what's different about those folks who are able to experience, quite frankly, even a tenth of what you've gone through and are still able to bounce back in some way or are able to redo the new lives so that they feel full and whole and vibrant, but just in a different way? What's a key component of that kind of person's life?
Well, I think, you know, what we're talking about is resilience, you know, and I think that there are certain protective factors that we all need in our lives because we're all facing a struggle. I mean, not everyone, you know, wakes up paralyzed in a spinal ward, but there are so many different challenges in life, you know, relationship, financial challenges, you know, illness. I think it's really important to be able to, a few things, you know, remind yourself that you're not alone in the experience, that other people are going through it. I have a practice that I have every morning, which I call giving grace, which is to be able to be thankful for the things that you have in life, because there always is. So it's important to focus on those things. And to to also, for me, it's important that I have things that I'm working towards. You know, that I think we're, you know, as human beings, we're goal-setting beings, and we need to have things that we can look forward to and things we can do. And sure, we might not be able to do the things we did before, but there's always something that we can go out there. It's such a rich and an abundant world that we live in. You know, don't give up that there's something that you can, that can ignite your soul, that you can find something that gives you a reason to get up every morning.
You have been celebrated by so many people who are sort of everyday names in a person's household. Sanjay Gupta, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, by give us a sense of some of the other folks who have really become a part of your world. I know you contribute to Deepak Chopra's workshops.
Well, I've been really blessed. You know, it's just been incredible to me. I mean, being able to share my story has been a tremendous help to me, not just, you know, in my healing, but being able to hear other people's stories. It's enabled me to get out and get some perspective that, you know, out of my, what I call out of my small story into a bigger human collective story. So I've been blessed that I've been, you know, able to speak for Deepak Chopra on many occasions, that, as you said, Dr. Sanjay Gupta is covered my story as well. And more recently, I was named by Maria Shriver as an architect of change, and I wrote a piece for that, which was on her website. And I'm just thrilled to be here, you know, in America, and sharing my story with people who have never heard it before. And it's just been a tremendous part of my journey, part of my healing experience. And I would say to anyone that's going through any sort of challenge right now is to, you know, start writing down, journaling your experience and making sure you share it with as many people as you can, because it's just a very important part of your own healing.
Janine, I would like for you to share with folks your website so those listening could get more information about what you're doing.
Absolutely. So my website is JanineShepherd.com, and they can go on there and join my community there. And I would say for anyone that's struggling right now, that it would be a great place to start would be to go to my TED Talk, A Broken Body Isn't a Broken Person, and maybe even if you know someone that's going through a difficult time, share it with them. And of course, they can also get my new memoir, Defiant, from any place where books are sold.
This is wonderful. Janine, again, I want to thank you very much for sharing your story and for your time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Pamela.
I am delighted to have been able to do so. And folks, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. You can get Mind Talk on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. There's also the Mind Talk app available through the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. And I would like to remind all of you, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.